Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, May 11th, 2006. I'm Brian Smith. Coming up on this morning's newscast, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council has adopted its first regional energy standard. The U.S. government has abruptly ended an inquiry into the warrantless eavesdropping program because the NSA refuses to cooperate. And Reporters Without Borders wants an investigation into the upsurge in murders of Iraqi reporters. Portland area weather today, partly cloudy, temperatures in the mid-50s to low 60s, and tonight mostly cloudy with a chance of showers, temperatures in the mid-40s. The Humane Society of the United States Sierra Club's Oregon Chapter, the Oregon Humane Society, the Cascadia Wildlands Project, and five other conservation organizations urging Ted Kulongoski to turn down a recently approved cougar management plan. The governor is likely to ask the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission to change the plan. The plan was approved about a month ago after years of scientific work and public comment. Under the plan, cougar numbers will be at least 3,000 in the state, with options of managing cougar-human conflicts, including human and pet safety and livestock damage. Another objective is to manage cougars in the area where the elk and deer populations are low. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
The Northwest Power and Conservation Council has adopted its first regional energy standard to help ensure an adequate energy supply for the Pacific Northwest. The four-state council adopted the standard Wednesday for its own planning process, but it recommended that utilities and public agencies across the region incorporate it into their planning efforts. The new regional standard is part of the electricity supply reliability assessment required across the West by Congress in recent national energy legislation. To develop the standard, the council and the Bonneville Power Administration established the Pacific Northwest Resource Adequacy Forum with representatives from regional utilities, public utility commissions, and public interest groups. The council is an agency of the states of Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington that was created by Congress with the Northwest Power Act of 1980. It oversees regional energy development along with conservation efforts for fish and wildlife.
The Constitution Party of Oregon is restarting its effort to recall the Marion County judge who ruled against Measure 37 last October. The party attempted to recall Judge Mary Mertens James shortly after her decision, but decided to halt the campaign because of concerns that signatures were collected on invalid petition sheets. Recall leaders filed new paperwork Tuesday, saying James should be recalled because of her decision on Measure 37 ignored the will of the voters. The Oregon Supreme Court eventually reinstated Measure 37, but Tom Steffen, the Sorokin businessman who is leading the recall effort, said that it's no reason to keep James aboard. James said the law unfairly gives longtime landowners development rights that aren't available to everyone, a violation of the Equal Protection Clause in the Oregon Constitution. She also said it undercut the authority of the legislature and didn't give a voice to neighbors who might object to what the person next door is building. Critics of the recall effort say such a step should be reserved for illegal or unethical conduct, not unpopular rulings.
The Roseburg Forest Products plant in Coquille cut 17 jobs this week because of new automation. 25 to 35 more layoffs are expected within the next year. Company officials say the plant has to compete with overseas operations and faces rising costs. Company officials said the 17 people who are laid off will get work providing illness and vacation relief. The company said by fall there may be enough attrition in the workforce that it can bring the 17 workers back full-time. Over the last 5 years, the Coquille plant has downsized by about 140 workers. Officials said the decision also is a result of rising costs and benefits and the crude oil that goes into resin for engineered wood products.
The government has abruptly ended an inquiry into the warrantless eavesdropping program because the National Security Agency, the NSA, refused to grant Justice Department lawyers the necessary security clearance to probe the matter. The Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, or OPR, sent a fax to Representative Maurice Hinchey saying they were closing their inquiry because without clearance, their lawyers cannot examine justice lawyers' role in the program. OPR counsel Marshall Jarrett said, "We have been unable to make any meaningful progress in our investigation because the OPR has been denied security clearances for access to information about the NSA program." Justice Department spokesman Brian Rorcasey said the terrorist surveillance program has been subject to extensive oversight, both in the executive branch and in Congress from the time of its inception. Rorcasey noted that OPR's mission is not to investigate possible wrongdoing in other agencies, but to determine if Justice Department lawyers violated any ethical rules. He declined to comment when asked if the end of the inquiry meant the agency believed its lawyers had handled the wiretapping matter ethically.
President Bush suggested yesterday that he'd like to see his family's White House legacy continue, perhaps with his younger brother Jeb as the chief executive. The president said Florida Governor Jeb Bush is well suited for another office and would make a great president. The president said he had pushed him fairly hard about what he intends to do. Jeb Bush has repeatedly said he's not going to run in 2008. But even his own father said no one believes him when he says he's not interested in running at some point. Former President George H.W. Bush told CNN's Larry King Live last year that he would like Jeb Bush to run one day and that he would be awfully good as president.
U.S. Senator Hillary Clinton, seen as a potential presidential candidate in 2008, praised President George Bush. She said, "He is someone who has a lot of charm and charisma, and I think in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I was very grateful to him for his support for New York." Hillary Clinton was participating in a talk at the National Archives about her life in politics. The junior senator from New York said she was still thankful for Bush's personal commitment to helping rebuild Lower Manhattan after 9/11. Some New York Democrats have since charged that the Bush administration has fallen billions of dollars short of that goal because some of the programs were underused. But Clinton said the president kept his promise.
At a press briefing yesterday, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld criticized Congress for not adequately funding Iraqi security forces. The U.S. military has spent just 40% of the $7 billion appropriated in 2005 for the training of Iraqi and Afghani security forces. A top Pentagon priority that is the linchpin for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Critics say Rumsfeld should stop blaming Congress and concentrate on effectively managing the taxpayer funding he's been given.
The Army Reserve has adopted a policy barring officers from leaving the service if their field is undermanned or they have not been deployed to Iraq or to Afghanistan or for the Homeland Defense missions. This is from the Washington Post. The Reserve has used the unpublicized policy, first adopted in 2004 and strengthened in May of 2005, to disapprove the resignations of at least 400 Reserve officers. Blocking Reserve officers' resignations is one of several steps the Army has undertaken in recent years to keep soldiers beyond their original terms of service, as today's war places unprecedented demands on the all-volunteer force. Under another practice known as stop-loss, thousands of active duty Army and Reserve soldiers have been temporarily prevented from leaving the military. But experts in the military law say barring Reserve officers from resigning is in some ways more expensive and open-ended than stop-loss. The policy applies to officers who do not fall under stop-loss. At the heart of the controversy is whether a law stating that commissioned Reserve officers are appointed for an indefinite term and are held during the pleasure of the president gives the government the power to force them to serve permanently, as Army lawyers say, or only to discharge them against their will.
Disaffection over spending and immigration have caused conservatives to take flight from President Bush and the Republican Congress at a rapid pace in recent weeks. The stampede has sent Bush's approval ratings to record lows and presents a new threat to the GOP's 12-year reign on Capitol Hill. Bush and Congress have suffered a decline in support from almost every part of the conservative coalition over the past year, a trend that has accelerated with alarming implications for Bush's governing strategy. The Gallup poll organization recorded a 13 percent point drop in Republican support for Bush in the past couple of weeks. These usually reliable voters are telling pollsters and lawmakers they are fed up with what they see as out-of-control spending by Washington and an abandonment of core conservative principles more generally. There are also significant pockets of conservatives turning on Bush and Congress over their failure to tighten immigration laws, restrict gay marriage, and to put an end to the Iraq war and the rash of political scandals, according to lawmakers and pollsters alike. This according to the Washington Post.
In an expanding call for answers, Republicans have joined Democrats in asking the Education Department why the test scores of many minority students are not being counted as promised under the No Child Left Behind law. The House Education and the Workforce Committee also plans a hearing on the issue. Last month, nearly 2 million students were not counted when schools reported yearly progress by racial groups. Most of these students were minorities. Under the law, schools may exclude math and reading scores when a racial group is too small to be statistically significant or when the privacy of students could be jeopardized. Some states are setting the minimum group size so high that they do not have to report scores by race even when they have large numbers of kids. That, in turn, makes it easier for schools to meet the law's goals and avoid penalties. The federal government approves the size of the racial group that the state set.
A Senate committee yesterday sent Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne's nomination as Interior Secretary to the full Senate, although procedural delays by lawmakers may stall his final confirmation to the cabinet. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee approved Kempthorne's nomination on a voice vote. No senator opposed Kempthorne, although Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana voted present to protest the Bush administration's refusal to share a portion of offshore oil and gas royalties with Gulf Coast states. Landrieu and Senator Bill Nelson of Florida have said they intend to place a hold on Kempthorne's nomination once it is reported out of the committee. Holds are a privilege any senator can invoke to block a measure from coming to a floor vote. Republican Senate leaders have said they will seek to override any holds on Kempthorne and bring his nomination to a floor vote before Memorial Day. Nelson said he's opposed to an Interior Department proposal allowing oil and gas drilling off the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. Nelson and Senator Mel Martinez say offshore drilling poses environmental risks that could threaten beaches crucial to the state's tourism industry. Kempthorne said last week he's eager to press President Bush's expansion of oil and gas drilling offshore and on federal lands as an antidote to the $3 gasoline price.
Twisters ripped through rural North Texas yesterday, reducing homes to concrete slabs and killing three people. At least 26 homes were destroyed in the storms that hit late Tuesday and early Wednesday, and 10 people were hospitalized and dozens of others were treated at the scene for minor injuries. National Weather Service meteorologist Alan Moeller said at least two tornadoes hit. I think it was the first tornado that killed three people, then there was a larger tornado after that that probably did extensive damage, he added. The damage track was estimated at a half mile wide and 6 to 7 miles long. Storms also raked Arkansas early Wednesday, toppling trees, damaging roofs, and downing power lines. In western Kentucky, flooding caused by heavy rains forced at least 9 homes to evacuate, and several people had to be rescued from the tops of their cars.
A homeless woman in Los Angeles was stalked to death as she slept on a sidewalk in downtown Skid Row. Witnesses said they saw an attacker repeatedly kicking Christy Morales for several minutes. A passerby attempted to intervene, but the attacker knocked the person down at least 2 times before an officer arrested him. Morales died from her injuries. She was the 4th person killed on Skid Row this year as police tried to crack down on crime in the troubled area. Police Chief William Bratton said her death highlights the plight of the homeless and the danger they face every day living, indeed sleeping, on the streets at night. In Los Angeles County, more than 82,000 people were homeless on any given night in 2005, including about 48,000 within Los Angeles city limits. This from the LA Times. The Army says it won't be able to meet a 2012 deadline to dispose of the country's chemical weapons stockpiles. Officials blame delays caused by state regulators and troubled chemical weapons incinerators. The U.S. has destroyed slightly more than 10,000 metric tons of a declared inventory of nearly 28,000 metric tons. Russia is even farther behind. It has 40,000 metric tons, the world's largest stockpile. But Russia has destroyed only 3%. Officials say their main plants for neutralizing chemical agents won't operate at full capacity until the end of 2007. The U.S. and Russia were supposed to have all chemical stocks destroyed by next year, but both countries are asking for a 5-year extension to 2012, and both are expected to miss that deadline too. The Army isn't projecting how long it'll take to destroy all the weapons.
Paris-based media watchdog Reporters Without Borders is calling on Iraq to set up a special investigation into the upsurge in murders of Iraqi reporters. So far this month, 5 journalists and media assistants have been killed. Last year saw a big increase in the number of Iraqi journalists targeted by gunmen and kidnappers. And the Iraqi security forces have been criticized for doing little to stop the attacks or find the perpetrators. The dangers for Iraqi journalists have been underlined in the grisliest way in the past few days. The body of a freelance journalist, Abdel Magdid al-Mohammadi, was found in Baghdad on May 5th. On the same day, Saud Masim al-Hadithi, a reporter on the satellite TV station al-Baghdadia, was found dead days after he had been kidnapped. His family said his body showed the marks of torture. Reporters Without Borders says that it can no longer find words to express its horror at the tragedies constantly suffered by the press in Iraq, noting that 93 journalists have been killed since the start of the war, and 18 of those deaths so far in 2006.
President Jalal Talabani said yesterday that nearly 1,100 people were killed in Baghdad alone last month, and urged Iraq's feuding factions to unite against surging crime and terrorism. But attacks continued across Iraq. Near Bakuba, 35 miles northeast of Baghdad, gunmen opened fire on a bus carrying Iraqi civilians to work, then planted a bomb aboard the vehicle that exploded when rescue workers arrived. In all, 11 Iraqis were killed and 6 wounded. Elsewhere, 13 Iraqis were killed in other attacks, including 4 off-duty policemen in Ramadi. Casualties from a suicide truck bombing in the northern city of Tal Afar on Tuesday night rose 22 dead and 134 wounded. The U.S. military flew some of the wounded to other cities when the local hospital was overwhelmed. Talabani, a Kurd, said in a statement that 1,091 bodies found in the Baghdad area in April were just the tip of the iceberg.
The U.S. has rejected the U.K.'s government's calls for closing down the Guantanamo Bay prison camp for terror suspects. U.S. officials said the camp housed dangerous people who could pose a fresh threat if they were released. The U.K. Attorney General Lord Goldsmith said yesterday that the camp's existence was unacceptable and tarnished the U.S. traditions of liberty and justice. The criticism shows a significant shift in the U.K.'s stance on the camp run by its U.S. ally, our correspondents say. The UK Prime Minister Tony Blair has in the past called the prison camp at the US base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, an anomaly. But in the strongest criticism yet from a UK government minister, Lord Goldsmith said the camp had become a symbol of injustice. Lord Goldsmith is said to have serious doubts over whether the indefinite detention of enemy combatants is legal or fair. Responding to the criticism, State Department spokesman Sean McCormick said the U.S. would like nothing better than to close Guantanamo down at some point in the future.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary has criticized China for making too little progress in reforming its exchange rate. But its latest biennial report did stop short of accusing Beijing of manipulating its currency. Last year, China revalued its currency, allowing it to float against a basket of currencies rather than linking it to a fixed rate at the dollar. But some U.S. politicians claim the yuan is artificially undervalued, allowing China to keep its export prices low. As a result, critics in the U.S. argue that the country is being flooded with cheap Chinese exports, leaving domestic rivals unable to compete and threatening jobs in America's industrial heartlands. Although he stopped short of accusing Beijing of illegal practices, Treasury Secretary John Snow did say he was extremely dissatisfied with the pace of China's currency reform. Despite the warning, the Treasury report did welcome technical steps to restructure the yuan under measures to lessen the country's reliance on exports. This from the BBC.
Multinational drug firms have begun to seek patents for AIDS drugs in India, according to The Guardian. The nation is a main source of cheap treatments, provoking protests from campaigners and patients who say this will stifle supplies of affordable therapies. Until last year, India permitted the copying of patents in drugs, which allowed the country's pharmaceutical industry to sell cheap versions of AIDS drug cocktails. Legislation enacted in March of 2005 curtails the ability of firms to make copycat treatments and allows foreign pharmaceutical companies to claim ownership of drugs. The California-based Gilead and Britain's GlaxoSmithKline have now applied for patents on two HIV treatments. Campaigners, lawyers, and Indian drug makers have opposed the applications, and more than 100 people were arrested in protest yesterday in Delhi. Activists say patents would drive up prices as Indian manufacturers would have to pay royalties and rival generic versions would be blocked for 20 years. Gilead has sought a patent on a key AIDS treatment called Tenofovir, while Glaxo has sought one for a widely used drug called Combivir. Lawyers say 8,000 patent applications are in the pipeline.
Indonesia's president has offered to mediate in the growing international dispute over Iran's nuclear program. Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono made the offer during talks with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who's on a three-day visit to Indonesia. Speaking after talks in Jakarta, Yudhoyono said he hoped the Iranian issue could be resolved peacefully. Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim nation and has valuable trade and energy deals with Iran. Iran's coming under increasing pressure from Western nations to curtail its nuclear activities. Authorities in Tehran claim these are purely peaceful, but the U.S. fears they are aimed at developing weapons. Iran is investing billions of dollars in Indonesia's oil and gas sector, and both nations are eager to boost trade. Ahmadinejad and Yudhoyono are expected to sign several agreements during the visit, including a deal to develop an oil refinery on Java, according to the BBC.
Relations between the U.S. and Russia sank to the lowest point in a decade yesterday when Vladimir Putin harshly rebuked Washington for its criticism last week and compared the U.S. to a hungry wolf that eats and listens to no one. Putin used his annual State of the Nation address to denounce U.S. expansionism and military spending. He also questioned Washington's record on democratic rights, although he refrained from mentioning the U.S. by name. It was clear that the wolf in question referred to Washington. The deterioration in relations is risky for the U.S. at a time when it is trying to persuade Russia to support a United Nations resolution against Iran over Tehran's nuclear program. The acrimony will also encourage senior U.S. Republicans such as John McCain to renew calls for Bush to boycott this year's meeting of the Group of Eight, the world's wealthiest countries, which is scheduled to be held in Russia for the first time. The war of words is a long way away from the optimism which George Bush said after his first face-to-face meeting with Mr. Putin in 2001 that he had looked into the Russian president's soul and liked what he saw, this according to The Guardian.
The World Food Program has reached agreement with North Korea to resume food and aid to the hunger-stricken country. The new program will feed almost 20 million of the most needy people in the north. That's down from the 6.5 million people the agency was feeding in past years. The agreement was signed yesterday in Pyongyang. The WFP will be allowed 10 foreign staff members in North Korea, and an agency has 32 foreigners in the country and 5 regional offices in addition to the capital. The agency would supply food aid only in areas where it could monitor distribution in order to assure foreign donors that the aid was reaching its intended beneficiaries. But the secretive Stalinist regime of North Korean leader Kim Jong-il has restricted activities of foreign aid agencies and pressed them to reduce the size of their foreign staff in the country. The WFP suspended aid in December after the North's government asked the agency to shift its focus to economic development aid. The two sides have been negotiating since then. This according to The Guardian.
Anti-drug police in northern Afghanistan have shot dead two farmers who resisted efforts to destroy their opium poppy crop. Sarayapur provincial governor Saeed Iqbal Munib said police opened fire after a group of farmers attacked them with stones and pieces of wood. He said two other farmers and 10 policemen were also injured. Afghanistan, the world's main producer of opium, is under international pressure to end poppy growing. The drug trade helps to finance anti-government insurgents, but farmers complain that they have no alternative. The BBC says police and drug traffickers have clashed on a number of occasions in northern Afghanistan, but this is thought to be the first time that farmers have been killed in such a clash.
China has blamed the Dalai Lama for an outbreak of violence at a Buddhist monastery in Tibet, accusing the exiled spiritual leader of stirring up unrest. The official Xinhua news agency said 17 Tibetans on March 14th destroyed a pair of statues at Lhasa's Ganden Monastery depicting the deity Dorje Shugden. Lhasa's mayor blamed the destruction on followers of the Dalai Lama, who sees Dorje Shugden as a divisive force. Analysts accused China of exploiting any dispute for political ends. The Dalai Lama has urged his followers not to worship Dorje Shugden, regarded as a powerful but dangerous protector. Instead of praying to Shugden, the Dalai Lama has urged all Tibetans to pray together and avoid internal conflicts. The mayor of Lhasa, Norbu Dunjub, said the apparent violence at Ganden Monastery was by no means an accidental event. Tibet's senior Communist Party official Zhang Kongli directly blamed the Dalai Lama, accusing him of encouraging monks to attack the monastery. This from the BBC.
A pro-whaling body affiliated to the Japanese government has set up a company that aims to sell 1,000 tons of whale meat, most for school meals over the next year, according to The Guardian. The meat will be sold cheaply to makers of school lunches, and there will also be plans to boost sales to family-friendly restaurants and hospitals. Although the International Whaling Commission, the IWC, banned commercial whaling in 1986, Japan continues to kill whales for what it describes as scientific research. Environmental groups and other IWC members, including Britain, have condemned the hunts as commercial whaling in disguise. The company set up by the Pro-Whaling Institute of Cetacean Research in Tokyo forms part of a countrywide campaign to reestablish whale meat in the traditional Japanese diet. The meat, a staple of school lunches before the IWC moratorium, is now found mainly in specialist restaurants. Much of the meat now on the domestic market comes from whales caught during a recent five-month scientific hunt in the Antarctic. Japanese whalers caught 850 mink whales, a figure more than double the quota for the previous year, as well as 10 fin whales, a species classified as endangered. Whaling officials said new channels of distribution were needed to handle the meat, expected to take supply to 5,500 tons, 1,500 tons more than last year.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, May 11th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news, KBOO's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Boone Rivers is on the board right now. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Brian Smith.
Who doesn't want to get up at 3:30 in the morning to work on the news? Okay, who does? If you want to volunteer, call us, 503-231-8032, extension 202. Portland area weather today, partly cloudy to the north, areas of drizzle along coast, temperatures in the mid-50s to 60s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of showers, lows 40 to 45.